Why do I have to do the show notes?
Because I'll give you the Hugo Award if we win it.
Oh.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm one of your hosts, Ian Mond, and to my left is my wonderful host who's also apparently got a very hot voice.
Oh, shut up.
Someone said you had a hot voice.
Yeah, and we said we weren't going to talk about that.
Well, no,
hang on.
I never said that. Ow!
Yeah, I have my pointy stick.
Where'd you get that from? Did you come outside? Look at that. Look at that big gnarled piece of wood there.
Yeah, it's my pointy stick, so ow. Behave.
Yeah, bit of a visual joke.
No, not with the squeal you made. That was awesome.
Thanks. Anyway, you've got a hot voice.
Okay, moving on. My name's Kirsten McDermott, by the way.
No, you didn't actually introduce me.
You're
right. Well, I didn't. Sorry, I missed that bit because I'm so intrigued by your hot voice.
And the pointy stick.
Yeah, so do you want to mention some of the feedback we got for last week's episode? Do you know our listenership numbers have doubled?
Oh, that's lovely.
I don't want to actually give the numbers, but it's more than going from one to two.
Okay, excellent.
But people who don't know us and wouldn't know us if they fell over us are actually listening to us.
They must be, because I don't think I know as many people as the numbers are.
Yeah, that's right. I definitely don't. So would you like to talk? You don't have any of the feedback around.
I don't have anything in front of me. You've got it all.
Yeah, because who has the iPad?
You have the iPad. I have the pointy stick.
That's... You can't keep using it. It does lose its power if you keep sticking in my ribs. Actually, that just hurts. So I was going to start with Amy, who's only sent a bit of feedback, actually, I think, today.
Yes.
So that's pretty, like, hot off the press.
Hot off the press.
And I think, because your 3G in this place is rubbish, it's taking forever for this to load. What? It is. I'm only getting two bars. Anyway, so here we go. She said that we brought up a really great discussion about The Book Thief, which we did. And, oh, sorry, I didn't finish the sentence. We brought up a really great discussion about The Book Thief being marketed at a young adult audience. It annoys me no end when publishers decide that just because there is a young protagonist that can't be considered adult fiction. She also says that Deathless sounds amazing, and that's because it is amazing.
It is amazing.
A great book. And thanks to your highly charged review, would that be both of us? Because I'm not highly charged, I'm highly strung.
Okay, you can be highly strung and I'll be highly charged.
You like highly charged?
That's what that'll do me.
I thought my highly strung thing would get better, bigger laugh from you. But anyway, thanks to your highly charged review, I have put it on my book order list to review myself. Well, that's fantastic.
Excellent.
And looking forward to many more colourful future podcasts. Colourful.
It's a visual thing.
It must be all that swearing. And then we got a bit of feedback from Cheryl Morgan, which is very – this, again, is also very recent.
Yes.
Do you – just out of curiosity, do you Google Alert?
I do, and this one didn't come up for some reason. Google may be a bit slow this week.
It came up for me because I've only just started Google Alerting because my ego only kicked in about 3 months ago.
That's not true. You probably just discovered Google Alerts.
No. And she spells your name right, so you should complain to Google Alert.
I know, but that's fine.
So she says, notes that this is one of the podcasts that she recommends, which is very nice of her, and says that, although there's only been two episodes thus far, they are doing a really good in-depth book discussions. But this is the crucial point she makes. I wish they were less hung up about spoilers. But in spite of that, we still managed to find lots of good things to talk about. So, Kirsten, spoilers.
Spoilers.
We've thought about this, haven't we?
Yeah. And
in the space of 24 hours.
Well, I think we kind of talked about it before we even started the podcast about how we would talk about books. And I guess we decided not to spoil them for people. But it does inhibit what – not necessarily what you can say, but perhaps backing up what you say. If there's something you particularly liked or didn't like about a book and you can't actually talk about it because it will reveal a crucial plot point, it kind of – you know, it inhibits what you get to say.
But doesn't this mean that no one's going to actually listen to the podcast? Because not everyone reads the books that we're talking about.
No, well, I don't know. I don't know why people if people are listening to the podcast because they've read the book, or if they're listening to it because they think they might want to read it, so they want to hear about it. I don't know. It's not the we haven't really been getting any feedback from that side of it. We seem to be pretty evenly split between people who are giving us feedback because they've read the book and either agree or disagree with what we've said, or people who are saying, oh, that sounds really good, I'll go out and read the book now. So, yeah, it's kind of a hard call. I have nothing really against giving spoilers, providing we give spoiler warnings. So I guess it depends, as I said to you before, do we want to keep this podcast as more of a review podcast, where traditionally in reviews you don't give away major plot points and twists and endings?
You haven't read enough reviews. There are, anyway.
Good reviews.
Okay. Oh.
And, or, you know, we're not talking about Andrew Bolt's film reviews here.
Okay.
Or do we actually make it more of a book club type podcast where we just talk about anything we want, including endings, including spoilers. And if you don't want to hear that before you've read the book, then maybe you can either read the book in the month before we broadcast, or listen to the podcast later after you've read the book.
I think that if you listen to the podcast later, it'll be very dated, considering we'll be talking about current events as they happen.
Oh, yes, us and George Negus.
Yeah. No one will get that joke anywhere out of Australia.
Us and George Negus.
There's Google. That's N-E-G-U-S.
Kirsten just dropped her stick.
I dropped my stick.
This is because the stick is a bad weapon. It doesn't sit up properly. So, here's the thing. Here's my thing. As certain people will know, I'm a huge spoiler phobe. I make this sort of noise when it's spoilers.
And for people who can't see, he's scrunching his eyes shut like he's just sucked lemons and putting his hand over his ears and running around the room like a child.
I'm not actually running around the room, but
you
close.
I would be.
I know a guy, this is a true story, and when he goes to the theatres, the pictures, as my parents call it.
The pictures, we used
they
to call
do.
It that.
You go to the pictures.
We're going to go to the pictures.
Yeah. And they used to call dinner tea as well.
Yeah, I never did that.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, when he used to go to the theatre, he still does this, and the trailers are on. I've got to describe it. He'd flick
his hand in front of his eyes
very quickly.
To form a screen.
Yeah.
How is that more efficient than just putting your hand on your eyes?
I'm not sure. That's what he used to do. He used to just quickly flick his hands in front of his eyes. Don't show me. Although I had that blocked out the sound.
Exactly.
I don't know
why didn't he just wait 15 minutes and then
He used to make a noise. He used to go,
oh, my God.
He is quite normal, has actually a high-paying job and everything. And
really?
Yeah. So what I'm proposing is that we do a full book discussion, but as we're talking, you're saying spoilers, I'll just go, and flick, and you just got to imagine me rubbing.
But you've read the books we're talking about.
Heavens to Betsy, you're right.
So
it's a lot more fun having these discussions than when we're talking about The Book Thief for 45 minutes and whether we should have.
Yeah, we're not mentioning that book again.
Never.
I'm kind of cross about you bringing up the feedback. As much as I love the feedback, thank you, Amy, but we're not mentioning that book again for at least 6 months.
Never. What book?
Exactly.
So the decision is, made mostly by Kirsten, so any flack should go to her, is that we will treat this like a book discussion group.
A book club.
Book club, yep.
Book group.
So we're giving you a month to read the books. It's the same month that we've got, because we actually don't know in advance.
No, we just swapped books 15 minutes ago when Ian turned up.
Yes, so you'll have as much time as we do. What we will do, though, is we will give a little bit of a description of the books that we're doing, because some of them won't be interesting to others, and I don't want to feel people compelled to read.
Yes, we will give a synopsis. And I think the only exception we'll make to this rule will be for books The Deathless, that people won't have been able to read. But we probably won't be doing too many of those anyway.
We're not that popular. So, look, that's it. There'll be spoilers. We'll talk endings.
It will mean there will be better discussions, and there'll be less of me sitting here tying my hands in knots because I can't actually say what I'd like to say.
And that's my fault, because I put you in that tiz.
You do.
Because you would have given away spoilers from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. In fact, you would have just read the entire book out. It would have been here for a long time.
Reader's Digest version.
You know, I don't know why people have a go that our podcast is a bit long, when you think that Sophonauts, the one that won the Hugo, those go for 3 hours.
Wow.
I mean, okay, 90 minutes of that. Yeah, nearly all of them. 2 hours to 3 hours. Okay, most of that's people reading stuff.
Yeah,
but who
yeah.
sits for 3 hours and listens to a podcast?
Well, I mean, the beauty of podcasts is you don't have to. You can just – you can dip in and out. You can – I know people who listen to them on public transport on the way to work, so it might take them a week to get through a long podcast because they listen to it in 15, 20 minutes.
So you're trying to say, like, this podcast, I'll be in the middle of a set and someone will press
That was actually really funny.
That was good, wasn't it? Yeah. Better than your visual stick joke.
Hey, I'll pick my stick up.
Okay. No, that's fair. So that was – and we also got something from a bloke, a very, very nice boy. He's not a boy. He's a grown man. He's not a toddler or anything.
Keep going.
Yeah, thanks. Jonathan, who said some very nice things about the podcast as well. And, in fact, I'm going to be quoting Jonathan McCalmont. Jonathan, if I've mispronounced your surname, too bad, because you can't do anything about it. I just won't say it again. So Jonathan, and I'm actually going to quote Jonathan, well, not actually direct quote him, but I'm going to mention his review of The Wind-Up Girl when we talk about The Wind-Up Girl, which will be reasonably soon. So,
yes.
Oh, and just to go back a step. No, don't roll your eyes. To go back a step, there'll be spoilers for these two books. So if you haven't read
The Wind-Up Girl. Yes, we've established that. Spoilers.
Yes,
spoilers. Sorry.
If you haven't read The Wind-Up Girl or The City in the City, prior to listening to this podcast, press stop after we've discussed whatever we're going to discuss before the book.
We'll tell you.
Yes.
Because we're very nice like that.
Yes. So, Kirsten.
Yes, Ian.
I hear some writing news for you.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. You threw me there for a minute.
I've changed the subject. We're beyond the spoiler thing.
Yes, I'm having a collection published by 12th Planet Press as part of their 12 Planets series.
Now tell me more about this 12 Planets series, Kirsten.
Stop it.
What?
Well, it's 12 books of four stories per volume.
Six by men and six by women.
Oh, you didn't even let me get through the introduction.
No,
you just jumped straight in there.
No, Alyssa's going to think that I've got an issue with this, obviously.
Yeah, she is. She'll hate you now.
And I do think that it's a pretty silly gesture. No, I'm kidding.
No.
I swear I don't,
Alyssa. I'll get you that last story real soon, I promise.
Yeah. Yeah, well, don't touch me with that stick. Don't.
I'm just holding it.
Okay.
It's my security stick.
I think it's actually fucking fantastic.
Oh, so do I.
2 years.
Yes.
12 authors.
Yep.
Six a year. All female.
Yep. All Australian. Yep.
And if that doesn't promote.
And it's really good. It's short fiction, but it's really open. So you have between 20 and 40,000 words per volume, but you can do kind of what you want within that. So, mine's got rather a long novella and it'll have three shorter pieces. Some collections might be linked by the world all the stories are in. Others might be linked by the theme or the tone of the stories. So they're going to be very, very good.
Can you speak about yours?
No, I can't.
Can you speak about yours off this podcast so I can know?
Okay. Sorry, listeners. Ian's so rude.
What? I just wanted to know.
I just told you about mine.
No, you didn't.
I just said I'm writing a novella and three shorter pieces.
You didn't tell me what they're about.
Well, they're what I write.
So who's on the writing list other than you? Who's on the 12?
Oh,
no, you have to know all the 12. I know because you don't have access to it. I'm not going to bring it up on this.
I don't have the list in front of me and I'll forget people and that's really horrible.
I know Sue Isle's doing one.
Yep, Sue Isle's the first one that will be out will be Sue's.
Tansy.
And Tansy Raina Roberts is doing one.
Margot.
See what you've done. Margot Lanigan, Kat Sparks has one.
Wow, these 12 female authors just roll off your tongue, don't they?
I hate you so much.
I know, you really do. That sticks.
Because names are popping into my head and I'm trying to remember if they're part of the 12 planets.
Is Debbie and Cotty doing one?
That's one I can see. I can't remember if Deb. I think she is. I think Deb. You know what? I'm just going to Google it. So
what you want to do? Thinking music?
No, you've got to talk.
Well, no, talk.
You can talk while I Google and I will retrieve the names.
That's a real struggle for me to talk. But
I know. Push yourself.
I just wanted to say that I'm not. I was. Take piss before, Alyssa. Okay. I think it is wonderful. And I think it's...
You should have seen him rolling his eyes.
Shut up.
Sorry. Continue.
I do think it's great because... And I don't think it's a case, even though it seemed that way, that it's a case of sort of reverse racism or reverse genderism. I think it's important... Now you're rolling your eyes.
Oh, I just rolled my eyes, yeah.
I think it's important that these voices are promoted because they can get shouted out. by others, especially in the genre.
Yeah.
Look, I do disagree with the idea that there is a gatekeeper sort of stopping female authors being published, but I do believe...
I don't think there's an explicit gatekeeper.
Would you allow me to finish? You're meant to be looking up the 12 authors.
I found them.
Okay, great. That was quick. I just think that it's not that there's a gatekeeper stopping. I think that there's possibly a reluctance on some on the part of some female writers to bother writing genre stuff. And here you'll have no,
yeah, no.
You disagree?
I disagree with that. But before I voice my disagreement, I'll just give you the names of the 12 Planets writers. We have Margot Lanigan, yes. Lucy Sussex, yes. Rosaline Love, Tansy Rayner Roberts, Deb Biancotti is doing one. Karen Warren, Kat Sparks, Sue Isle, Narelle Emma Harris, Thoreau Dyer, Steph Campisi, and myself.
That's great. That is a wonderful lineup. Yes. Now, why am I wrong?
I don't think it's not bothering to write genre fiction at all. I mean, it's funny because...
That's not what I said.
You did. You said, oh, reluctance. My God, let's have a semantic discussion now.
Can I have the stick?
No, it's my stick. No, I don't think it's a reluctance so much. I just disagree. I think of the female writers that I've
So why do it
to.
Then? Why do 12 female writers over 2 years?
Well, Alyssa is very much for pushing female writers because they do tend to be over.
Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate here on this one.
Okay, yep.
Okay, we're not Galactic Suburbia, so we're not really focused around
please
gender issues.
Be
but
advocating but of the devil.
Could you argue that, here we go, this is good, there's a pretty good, in Australia specifically, there's a very good run of female writers who get published, and in fact you could argue that male writers in Australia don't get as much exposure as female writers do. How's that?
Yeah.
You could tell I pulled that right out of my ass.
There are a lot of female writers in genre. In fact, in before Alyssa released the list, there was a lot of speculation over who just would be the other 11. Because I mean, me and my friends, because we were talking about. So obviously, I was one. I was saying, well, who else would there be? And there's at least, just off the top of my head, six writers at least who I thought of would have, you know, could have been in the collection or in the series who aren't. There's a lot of female writers writing in Australia. So absolutely that's the case. But then why wouldn't it be? We do make up half the population.
Okay. So therefore 12 Planets is?
Is?
What's the mission statement? Not that you're the publisher. But
I'm not the publisher.
But I'm just asking.
It's to promote women writers in spec fic, I would think.
Good. That's quite obvious. Do they need to be promoted?
I think
they
do.
Because that's the question, that's the debate, that's the dialogue. Do they need to be promoted? Do we really need to do this?
Yes, I think we do. If you have a look at the... yes, we still need to do it. We still need to do it because if you have a look at... When you talk about there's no gatekeeper,
yep.
It's true. There's no, you know, there's no man standing at a gate saying, "Oh, you get to come in. You don't." Sorry, tits.
I'm just imagining this guy going, "Tits,
be
out.
Gone." But they're very much our gatekeepers, and then you know, it's. I had a discussion with someone about a year ago about this, and
no, you just said there weren't. What do you mean there are?
There's not. Specific people who are appointed by some vague committee who get together every month and decide who does and doesn't get published and who does and doesn't get recognised. But of course there are gatekeepers. There are gatekeepers at every single point of publishing. Editors are gatekeepers, publishers are gatekeepers, reviewers are gatekeepers, people who make podcasts are gatekeepers. Anyone who is in any position of authority to determine who hears about books, who hears positive things about books and negative things about books is a gatekeeper in a sense.
So what you're saying is we as podcasters or reviewers especially can ignore a line of books or can ignore a bunch of authors because, well, we just don't like girly stuff.
We can ignore them, we can dismiss them, which is often worse than ignoring them.
And because Alyssa has a pretty reputable small press publishing company now, she's saying, well, I'm reputable and I'm now going to publish these 12 female writers, and essentially you won't be able to ignore them because they're going to be out exactly. there, they're going to be in your face.
Exactly. And I think that's admirable. And I think, I mean, you talk about, in Australia, the genre small press is, you know, quite, in terms of the male-female representations, I think it's fairly balanced in the science fiction fantasy end of things, less balanced in the horror end. But then Australia is you know, not the world. And if you have a look at awards lists that come out and tables of contents in prominent anthologies, there's still a huge, you know, imbalance in the genders. And let's not even get into other issues. But I think this is good.
And I will be buying all 12.
So, excellent.
And I think it's about $200-odd to get all 12 over the 2 years.
Oh, no, it's less than that. If you're in Australia, I think it's only 180 shipped. I think it's 220 or something like that for internationals. But Australia, it's a bit less.
I think that
and
is
the
amazing
beautiful
value.
Thing is...
That's 2 years of books.
Yeah, and it's a subscription. So you pay it up front, and then for 2 years you get a book every you know, for 6 months of the year, kind of, you get a book almost every month.
Yeah, no, I'm well into that.
It'd be like a little surprise. I'm like, oh, I forgot I was getting this one.
And Alyssa, 12th Planet, does produce magnificent books.
It does.
They look beautiful. So everyone should go and buy it and should support Australian Small Press. And I really didn't have an end to that sentence, but it's okay.
Yeah. And
now, I should know that Ticonderoga are also, because they're another Small Press publisher, they're also doing quite a few female collections.
They are.
You've got
lot.
Angela Slatter.
There's a lot coming out who have come out and who are slated to come out in the
Felicity
next couple of
Dauker
years.
Felicity Dauker is doing one.
I think Felicity's will be 2012.
Okay.
They have already published Angela Slater, Karen Warren's was published. They were both around about WorldCon.
But Angela's
so
doing
September
another one, isn't she?
Year. No.
Okay. Was it Lisa Hannett then?
Lisa Hannett's doing one. I think Lisa and Angela are doing one together. Is what it is.
You know, if they're listening to this and you're wrong, they're just going, no, that's not what's happening.
Oh, sorry, guys. No, I think that's it. But, they're bringing out – Russell made quite a few announcements in the space of a very short time. So it's good. There's a lot of new authors.
But as I came
in – Oh, Leslie Robbins also.
Oh, okay, yep. As I came in tonight, you had a bit of a quibble with the submission guidelines for a Ticonderoga publication. Would you like to expand on that?
Well, this is just it's the new horror anthology, which is called Darkest Hours, and it's going to be an annual anthology, from what I gather. A new stories, not reprints. So it's not a best of. It's new stories. And Angela Chalice from Brimstone Press is actually editing the series, which is good. Angela is a fantastic editor. She's got a really good eye for dark fiction. And I'm really looking forward to the series, actually.
There's a but coming.
But I think on the weekend, the formal guidelines, they haven't been put up on the Ticonderoga site yet, but I think they will be soon. But they were announced on horoscope.com.
Yep.
I'll just read them rather than paraphrase it. But so Angela's set down the guidelines as dark, gritty, and sophisticated storylines are sought for Darkest Hours, an upcoming horror anthology by Ticonderoga Publications. The vision for Darkest Hours is one of despair, loss, and/or hardship in a fast-paced urban horror setting. No high fantasy or hard sci-fi worlds, although their settings are welcome regardless of era, location, or social construct. The horror can be psychological and or supernatural. And then the next paragraph says, a masculine tone will be favoured but not sought exclusively. That is, avoid becoming bogged down with intricate descriptions and fancy window dressing in your world building. Save your word count for a solid scene or two or three of conflict, aggression, action, etc. Stories that weave suspense, thrills, and or mystery around the horror will also be favoured, and then there's the usual word counts and
so your like problem is the use of masculine
tone. It's really...
Is that a common description? Like, I've never seen that.
I haven't seen it either, and it's really problematic, and I'm on the Southern Horror mailing list, Yahoo group, and there was a little conversation going around it today because Angela had posted the guidelines and was actually asking for a critique. She was actually concerned about the urban setting. She was because she doesn't just want stories set in cities.
Yeah.
So she was wanting advice on how to clarify that, and real world was suggested as an alternate thing. But I mean, the real problem with me was not the urban part; it was the masculine tone, and the masculine tone, which is it's given a value because you know when she talks about what it is and what it isn't, that the when she's talking about you know don't put in intricate descriptions and fancy window dressing blah blah blah, she uses bogged down. So it's a negative association. It's not just saying, well, you know, there are stories that are poetically worded and have lots of description and that's fine, but I don't want them. What I want are these other stories. She's made a value judgment about those two, and then she's actually gendered that value judgment. So, you know, masculine, not only is this a masculine tone, but it is better than this girly stuff, which I kind of objected to, and I'm not sure she's going to change the guidelines. She didn't really see a problem with that, but...
Well, we'll see what happens. Yeah. And I mean, look, it shouldn't stop people from submitting to the anthology, though it might stop some people from. I mean, I don't know. We're not here to attack Ticonderoga or Angela. I think it's just it comes down to the point of use again of language. And also, one of the things that, I mean, here I am, I'm a man and I'm white and I'm entitled and I'm privileged. And up until about 2 years ago, terms like male gaze and gender bias and all those things didn't mean anything to me, and I'm now 36. So we're not talking like I'm a 15-year-old who's seen the light. I've had entrenched, I suppose, sexism of a sort without knowing it for a long time.
Well, when you're in a privileged position, you're very often not forced to look at this stuff because you are in a position of privilege. Well, so it doesn't come up.
A couple of years ago, I wouldn't have batted an eyelid at masculine tone.
No.
Would have just been, well, it's a term. It means ballsy. It means pared down. I see it. And yeah. I go, ugh. It's...
Yeah, and again, ballsy is gendered, but you know the word using, like fast paced and you know pared down, all of that, they're not gendered terms. And I could name a number of writers of either gender who would fall on either side of that divide. And to say that, you know, a writer who happens to be a woman and writes very stripped back, action-oriented prose is writing like a man, which is essentially what you're saying when you're talking about masculine and feminine tones, is really problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, I wouldn't have seen it that way. But it's only through things like Galactic Suburbia, which I know we mention them every podcast, but then they mention us nearly every podcast. So, you know, it's that sort of reciprocal thing that's really got me seeing things in a different light. And, yeah, I now sort of – I do cringe at that.
Yeah, and again, it's nothing to do with – I mean – wanting a certain type of story is fine, and I don't have a problem with that at all. It's just using a gendered descriptor for that.
Okay,
is the issue.
Well, look. Anyway, I mean, we'll see what happens with that. I don't know if that's going to become a big issue or not. But it's just interesting about the use of language, and in fact, it is going to tie into our discussions on the two books, which is probably a good excuse now to talk about the two books.
Yes, yes. So? Let's go right in because we've
got
half
first?
An hour. I don't know. You pick.
Okay, let's do the City in the City.
City in the City, okay.
Yeah. So okay. So
I recommended that one.
Yes. So basically, I'll read the back of the book. First off,
you have a back.
You've got the hardcover, which has got quotes from about 38 people saying how good the book is.
Actually, they're all quotes saying how good his other books are.
Oh, okay. Of course, because of the hardcover, they haven't read that. Yes, of course, yes. That old trick. You know what I have a problem with this? That it was called Chandler-esque. But anyway, let me get onto the back of the book. So
it's got a very masculine tone. Sorry, couldn't resist.
I can think of someone who may not be listening to this podcast ever again if she ever did. So we've got China Mayville delivers his most accomplished novel yet, an existential thriller.
Oh, can you stop?
That. Okay. But I do it really well. An existential thriller taken to dazzling metaphysical and artistic heights.
Get the stick.
No, okay, sorry. So the plot is when the body of a murdered woman is found in the extraordinary decaying city of Bezail?
Bechel is how I was saying it. It may be wrong. It probably is.
Decaying city.
We're going to make a lot of pronunciation errors today, I'm sure.
Yes. So Bechel, somewhere at the edge of Europe, it looks like a routine case for Inspector Boileau of the Extreme Crime Squad. But as he probes the evidence, the evidence begins to point to conspiracies far stranger and more deadly than anything he could have imagined. Soon his work puts him and those he cares for in danger, as it often does. Boileau must travel to the only metropolis on Earth as strange as his own, across a border like no other. It's a crappy blurb, but it was probably written by China that I've said it, but it provides a reasonably non-spoiler-esque
Yeah, which I think was very important for a book like this, which, again, I shall now remind people who may have just, I don't know, pressed the 30-minute button on the thing. We're going to be spoiling this book. So if you have not read it yet and haven't really heard a lot about it, probably pause now, go find it, read it, and then come back.
Yes. Well said.
Some and for those of you still with us.
Are we going to pause now for like 10 seconds
while people
press stop?
For those of you still with us, we'll now be talking about The City and the City.
Yes. So what's the name of the other place? Because I've already forgotten.
Ulcoron? Ulcoma.
Yeah, okay. So basically it's a murder mystery. Okay, that's what it is.
So
that's what we've got here. It's been described as Chandler-esque, though.
It's
about as Chandler-esque.
Yeah, they're just tagging the detective thing. It's also been described as Kafka-esque, which I found ludicrous.
Anything weird is called Kafka-esque.
No,
only person they haven't dragged in is Thomas Pynchon or, you know, someone like that.
I've heard Borges has been compared to this.
Yeah, well, actually, no, but there is a Borges story that is similar to this.
Yeah, but...
Georges Louis Borges.
Yeah, probably. Kafka's weird. Kafka's not just weird.
Who's read Kafka?
Sorry?
Who's read Kafka? Do you think the people who do the quotes have read Kafka? Or they've just read Metamorphosis?
I would hope they've read Kafka. I don't think they're talking about Metamorphosis. I think they're talking about things like The Trial and
but there's nothing like The Trial.
No, there isn't, because Kafka is, for the most part, I mean, when you think about Kafkaesque, because he wrote a lot of different stuff, you think sort of absurdist, surrealist fiction, and The City in the City is not absurdist. It's not surrealist. It's almost not spec fiction.
In fact, that's wrong, what you just said. I know people have been saying that. It's very po-faced, if anything. It's very straight down the line,
it
earnest.
Is.
There's no sense of China having a wink-wink nudge. He's taking this extremely seriously. And what is he taking extremely seriously? The idea, you loyal listeners.
Which gave you a migraine.
Which gave me a migraine.
Love the idea.
Of two cities on top of each other. They're spatially connected in some way.
Yeah.
The fact that I can't properly describe it is probably
indicative
of how I feel about it.
It's not just two cities. They're sort of city-states. So it's not two cities in the same country or anything. They're city states.
Yes.
You have to actually get a passport to leave one and enter the other and all that sort of stuff. But they share a geographic
location.
Location, not for the most part, literally on top of each other. It's divided into three parts. You've got if you're a resident of one of the cities, you'll have your areas which are total, meaning they're completely within your city. You've got the areas which are alter, which means they're completely outside your city. And you do have some areas that are cross-hatched, and they're the tricky ones where you might have within a space of a few hundred metres, this shop is in your city, that shop next to it
isn't. You know that migraine?
And all that.
Is
kind
back. This is what I don't get.
They're not physically, physically isolated.
Yeah.
There's not a spec fic trope of you actually having to go through a barrier or...
Well, there is.
No.
There's not
a physical barrier. You don't have to pass through a plane
like a special
like
shimmery sort of void.
It's all grounded in the physical world.
That is spec fic because that is impossible. There is no such thing as to spatially...
It's not impossible because it's not impossible. We're not talking about, like I said, two cities which... for example, if you're going to do along sort of quantum physics lines and say you had two cities that were sort of literally on top of one another, and you had to go into another dimension or another plane to access a city. But they were actually, you know, if you're looking at points on a grid, they would be on an identical spot. They're not. I mean, it's like, you know, you're walking through Melbourne and Collins Street yes. is in Bejel.
Yeah.
and you cross Collins Street. Sorry for those people not in Melbourne. You just have to imagine or
come visit Melbourne.
You know, come visit Melbourne. We'll make you coffee. You know, and you cross Collins Street and you go up to Bourke Street. And Bourke Street is in Ulcoma. But Bourke Street and Collins Street are physically in the same world. They're right next to each other. They're no different. The way the cities are separated are in the perception of its residents, not in the physical world.
Come again? What?
The cities are separate.
This is what I didn't get.
The cities are separate. No,
I feel
because,
like an idiot because I completely missed this whole conceptual.
The cities are separated only in the perception of their residents.
You're telling me it's entirely perceptual.
It's entirely perceptual. It's like, and I suspect an inspiration for the book was probably Jerusalem, where you have areas of Jerusalem that are segmented.
Yeah, there's four quarters in Jerusalem.
Right. Yeah,
I don't get it. I can get the four quarters of Jerusalem because there's four quarters.
Okay.
When I go through the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem, I don't suddenly go,
if you extrapolate yeah, it right. to the point
yeah.
where if you went through the Armenian quarter
yeah.
and you refused to look, you know, I mean, it was just you were physically going through it, but you just actually – you wouldn't get
it doesn't
without
work,
a passport.
It doesn't work.
You go around it.
Because it doesn't work.
I think it works.
Because because as you said, there are bits that are cross-hatched.
Yep.
There are bits that are total yep. and bits that are outer, yeah?
Yep.
So the cross-hatched stuff exists in both worlds, the co-located.
There's no both worlds. It's the one world. They're two cities. I think this is what is confusing you. They're not two worlds. They're two cities. Think Bourke Street, Collins Street. Bourke Street is in Bejel. Collins Street is in Ulcoma. So you can walk along Bourke Street and you can turn up Russell. Oh, when you get to Collins, no, sorry, you'll have to go back and go around.
I don't understand how you can build a society around that sort of.
Well,
this is where I just – it was the driving that really got me. Okay? it was the driving that I just couldn't understand because you're driving on a road and an agreed shared road.
If you're on an agreed – if you are on –
and you're not meant to notice the traffic that you – and I don't even know how you'd even know that
thing,
guy there – is from another place.
Well, the signifiers of the two cities, they're signified as you would, I guess, in any two countries. They're signified by architecture, by dress, by the mannerisms, by the language. The languages are very different.
Yeah,
and the idea is that you don't – it's not like you don't actually see – the altar parts.
You're not allowed to recognize.
You just don't. You just don't acknowledge that they're there.
Yeah, I get. I do.
And
I get that. I don't want our listeners to think that I'm completely yeah. stupid, but I do get that. And to make this matter more
really,
complicated, you've got the breach.
It is well. This is
who are a metaphysical type of force.
I don't think they are.
Shit, you really did not read this book the way I did. I read this as purely spec fic.
You could, but I think.
So how do I read the breach?
Well, the breach are the police force.
Yeah, but they appear
high level. Well, no, we never actually see anything that there's a lot of rumours about the breach as you get about essentially a secret police force.
Yeah,
that is the most powerful police force in both cities that can take people away and disappear them, and you'll never see them again. And so there's a lot of rumours that float around among the populace of both cities about breach.
Who have their own part of the city.
Who have
sort of because they have a complex that they seem to come in and out of.
Yeah, but breach will breach is used two ways in the book. Breach is the branch of the police force that monitors.
Yep.
And breaching, if you commit a breach, that means you have wandered into the other city without.
So, but this is the thing I don't get about cross-hatched. Okay.
Yeah. Well, they're not literally overlaid on each other.
It's the language
they're
then
just
that was
areas
used.
That are really
yeah.
They're meshed up. I mean, there are some that are kind of shared, and you can walk down that street. But if you're walking down the street in Bechel, and you see an Ulcoman coming towards you, you can't acknowledge that they're there. And you certainly couldn't go into an Ulcoman shop that's on the street.
I would never have been a good. I would never have been a good engineer. I'm really bad at visualizing this sort of stuff, and that's why it gave me a migraine. Yeah. I just went with it. The only way I could deal with it as a book, we haven't really talked about the quality. We've just got so sucked.
I know. Concept. It's a really good conceit. I really, really love.
And
the
I get
idea.
That. And I didn't hate the book because of that. The only way I could read the book and enjoy it was if I just did sort of some sort of weird spec fic thing where, not that there's a shimmery void, but that it's just basically. A bit like a Salvador Dali painting,
but no, I think
it's an illusion in a it's sort of.
But that takes away. I think if you read it like that, it takes away a great big. It takes away a lot of the sophistication and a lot of the way that the characters have to behave. I mean, it's because the division of the cities is not. It's not a physical thing. It's not something that that you come up against. Without knowing or against your will, it's a supreme act of will on the part of every single person who lives in either of those cities. Every moment is an act of will not to recognize the other city when you come.
So why were there distortions on the phone for people who ring from different parts of the city? Is that because the exchanges are different?
Yeah, the exchanges are different. Their internet is everything is different. They're completely two separate states. It's like you know being in I don't know in Romania and calling someone in Hungary. Except Romania and Hungary in this case are kind of overlapping.
If I had the time and I wasn't doing Last Short Story.
Yes, you'd read it again.
I'd probably have a look at it again. Yeah, but I just don't have the time, and I think I just have to accept that this one.
And this is only the setting, anyway. I mean, it does actually.
But it's integral to the plot.
It is, especially in the way the case is solved.
Yes.
The murder case that Theodore is investigating. So, it is essential. It's not just here's this funny place that set a story in it.
So basically, there's a murder and
a brutal
murder of an American student.
He's on an archaeological dig.
Yes.
Which is the one place I thought he was turning genuinely. Speculative fictional, and he didn't, which was cool.
Again, I was seeing what do you mean?
With the third city, Orsini.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because there's all this stuff about a rumor that there is a third city that's hidden between the folds.
Yeah, that's of the other somewhat two. Sort of an interstitial city, yeah. I guess. If that had been true,
these two aren't interstitial cities because there's a third city that actually is rumored to be interstitial.
Yeah, and for a while, the book is leading you towards thinking that there is this magical interstitial city which lives in the gaps, maybe that's where Breach comes from. But it's not. It ends up being completely false.
I went to university. I even did a bachelor's degree. I did philosophy. No, I did philosophy.
Well, there's your problem.
Now, admittedly, I didn't do modal logic or any of that stuff. But how does a book like this, which actually, from a philosopher's point of view,
it's fascinating,
is a wet dream? How does a book like this just completely go over my head?
No, I don't know.
Please, let's do psychoanalysis. We've got another hour.
Well, I think it's a way. You've come into it because if you've come into it with you've read a lot of Mieville's other work,
yeah,
and it's quite flagged. Or his work and Mieville as an author is flagged as spec fic, and quite quite high speculative fiction. Most of his works are very fantastical, and there is. Very much another world about them.
He does. I think he did say somewhere that he was inspired by quantum entanglement or quantum whatever.
Yeah. But so if you've come into that book with all of if you come into the city in the city with all of that,
yeah,
and if that's what you're expecting, then I think you kind of could read it like that. But then I think it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense.
How do the Breach know? Well, it still made sense, but how do the Breach know when there's a breach? Because it was a mystical aspect to that.
Because they don't know. I mean,
no, but the whole point of the murder mystery.
Yeah,
spoiler territory.
Theodore has to tell them. Theodore has to try and prove.
No. Wait. With the whole point of the murder mystery is that it's done. The murderer does it in such a way.
Yeah.
That Breach couldn't get involved. Well, it's actually it's a conspiracy in a sense.
It's a conspiracy in a sense, but the murderer has committed Breach. Not in the murder, but in the body disposal.
Yeah, so the person's killed in the other city. I'm not going to bother pronouncing the names of them. In the other city.
Yeah.
And then moved to the city of our protagonist.
Yeah.
And that, in a sense,
that's
considered to be
unless
Breach.
Unless they did it legally.
Through customs.
Through customs.
Yeah, which is what they did. So that my thought,
but Theodore, who doesn't want, he doesn't want the investigation. It's a messy murder. He doesn't want it. He's trying to pass it off to Breach.
But it's this whole thing about so invoking the first part Breach. The committee get together and they invoke
it. It's not invoking as in, you know, chanting.
Well, that's
mystical.
What it was.
No, it's just invoking Breach.
It's made a big deal of, like, if you've got
it. Well, I think he's using the language.
Oh, he's annoying China.
He's using the language, but the point is that Breach is Breach is like the secret police. So they have cameras, they have informants, they have spies. They notice acts of Breach a lot, but acts of Breach also have to be reported. And in this case, because Theodore doesn't want to handle the crime for various reasons, he's trying to prove that Breach was committed somehow around it, and therefore it would get taken away and someone else wouldn't have to worry about it. So that's sort of the first half-ish of the book, is him trying to prove that, not necessarily trying to solve the crime exactly, but trying to prove that Breach was, an act of Breach was involved
he wouldn't have to be involved, then
Breach.
And of course, as happens in these books, he becomes obsessed in the crime and gets dragged in and ends up being the hero of the piece,
and that's the thing. So Breach isn't metaphysical.
Yeah, I'm getting that now. I'm glad we do this podcast because I just would have spent.
And
my
this
life.
Is why I say that I mean, it's interesting. I think this book could have been marketed as kind of straight literary fiction.
I mean, look at I'm holding the cover of the Pan Trade or paperback.
Actually, it has, because it's just marketed as fiction on the back here.
Yeah, it's just marketed as fiction, and the cover is.
I think
as
if China hadn't,
how boring is that cover?
It's not great. I like mine on the hardcover better.
The red hardcover, yeah.
I think which is marketed because you've got kind of marketed as, I don't know. Anyway, but the thing is, if China hadn't already written the books he'd written, I'm not convinced that this would be spec fic.
Mm. Well, it won the Hugo Award.
I mean, in terms of marketing.
Yeah. It won the Hugo Award.
It won almost every award possible.
Yes.
Won the Hugo, it won the Locus Award for Best Fantasy Novel, it won the Arthur C. Clarke Award.
Best Fantasy Novel, you note that.
Yep, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the World Fantasy Award, the British Science Fiction Award, it was nominated for a Nebula.
So it's won Science Fiction and Fantasy Awards, so obviously everyone's confused. I'm not the only one. You wouldn't necessarily, I mean, you're happy that it won the Hugo.
Oh, yeah, look.
You voted for it.
I did.
Yeah. You know.
You're welcome, China.
You know, I didn't vote for this because I hadn't read it. I voted for the Bajigalupi.
Oh.
And they're tied. So we cancelled each other out. Because you didn't vote for the Bajigalupi, did you?
No, well, I only voted for one. I voted for the...
I've been holding that secret for a long time that I didn't... Because I thought it was because of me that they were tied.
Because if
I hadn't voted, one
of
them would
have won. Well, it quite literally was because of you. And because of every single other person who voted.
Shut up, Kirsten. So... yes, it's won a number of awards. Interesting that you're not calling it spec fic as to whether
I don't know. It's sort of, and again, this is the whole discussion about what is speculative fiction.
And Jonathan and Gary on Coot Street do talk about a book that talk about stories that have a science fiction feel that without
a feel.
Actually, this has that. Well, it obviously has that feel because I thought.
Yeah. And again, it's like, I don't know. Is
but Locus put it into fantasy. That's interesting. Those are smart people at Locus, but they've not seen it as SF.
I don't think it's SF. I don't think there's anything science fictional about it.
So the only thing that's, if it's going to be spec fic, it's fantasy.
I guess so. But again, I don't think there's anything I mean, the psychology of the residents of the two cities, I guess, is kind of fantastical. There's, you know, you have to sort of debate over whether that.
I didn't buy that. Yeah, I didn't buy the psychology. But look, as a book, I thought it was great.
Yeah,
I thought it was easy to read. Although China does have these odd turn of phrases that puts me off sometimes. Is as I'm reading, just a jarring turn of phrase, and I'd like to pick one out, but I can't. But I especially towards the beginning, especially at the beginning of the book. But I thought it was. Yeah, enjoyable to read. It does get a bit messy towards the end for me. Although the murder mystery aspect is dealt with quite well.
Yeah, I think that the crime story, which is essentially what it is, is a crime story.
That's dealt with. It's not left ambiguous.
Yeah, no, I think that plot line is quite well done, and the, resolving it is very clever too. So
we're recommending this?
I would definitely recommend it.
Is it a book about immigration?
Is it a book about immigration?
And about...
I think it's a book about
refugees and homeless people. Well, I mean, about immigration, about that alienation between borders.
I don't know that it's about immigration per se. I think it's an interesting commentary on, ideas of radical multiculturalism, where you have separate cultures living within a society, but they're not necessarily living together. They've kept themselves very isolated, and this, I guess, is a further extension of that idea. If you keep your culture so isolated from the other cultures, then you kind of are living in a separate place.
That was very deep, but basically what I thought as well.
Okay, you can have that.
But you said it better, so why should I repeat it? And on that note, so how are we going for time? Because I'm really nervous about this now.
I don't know, because it stopped halfway through. Sorry if there was a little blip in that discussion of the city and the city.
So we not record?
No, it got recorded. I just had to pause and restart it for some reason. So.
Okay.
But we're fine.
So we don't know how long we've been going for?
Oh, a little bit.
Okay. So this is our second book.
Yes.
The one that tied for the Hugo with The City and the City, The Wind-Up Girl, which I recommended to you, though breaking all the rules of this podcast.
Stretching some of the rules.
Because it wasn't one of my top 10 books of last year, even though I read it last year. It's not a book that I particularly think you... I think it's a good book, but I have real reservations about it. But I thought, wow, we're doing the Hugos.
I think the rule is not necessarily that you have to recommend a book to each other that we absolutely love, but... It's more that we can't make each other read a book that we hate.
Yeah, and I didn't hate this book. I didn't hate this book at all.
So.
Okay. Describe The Wind-Up Girl, because I did The City and the City.
I found a really good synopsis of The Wind-Up Girl.
Should we even be bothering doing synopses?
Let's shut up. You're just wasting time. The Wind-Up Girl is set in the 23rd century. Global warming has raised the levels of the world's oceans, carbon fuel sources have become depleted, and manually wound kink springs are used as energy storage devices. Biotechnology is dominant, and megacorporations like AgriGen, PureCal and Red Star, called calorie companies, control food production through gene-hacked seeds and use bioterrorism, private armies and economic hitmen to create markets for their products. Frequent catastrophes such as deadly and widespread plagues and illnesses caused by genetically modified crops and mutant pests ravage entire populations. The natural genetic seed stock of the world's plants has been almost completely supplanted by those that are genetically engineered to be sterile. And it is set in the kingdom of futuristic kingdom of Thailand, whose current monarch is a child queen. The capital city is below sea level and is protected from flooding by levees and pumps, and the three most powerful men in Thailand are the Somdet Chowpraya, the regent for the queen, and the chief environment minister, General Procha, and the chief of trade ministry, Akarat. And we follow, I guess, the adventures of a few people living within that world.
I have a question for you, Kirsten McDermott.
Yes.
How did this book... win the Hugo, even though I voted for it, so and I didn't even like it that much. So I don't know what that says about me. I mean, of the books that I read, I don't think.
So you didn't like it so much, and you voted for
well,
it Hugo.
Well, okay, I didn't read The City and the City. And
you
I would
owe
have,
China half a Hugo award.
I hadn't read The City and the City. Yeah, you're right. I feel bad. I do feel bad. It's been a thing. It's been a little thing that I've been holding.
And anyway, as you were, it's not only won the Hugo. It's also won just about every award. The City and the City's one due to a vagary of years and publications and countries and so on. So it's also won the Nebula, the Locus Award for Best Novel, the John W. Campbell. It's currently nominated for the British Science Fiction Awards because it was published in the UK last year as opposed to 2009, so that it gets another run. So it's won a lot of awards, not just the Hugo.
So the books that I read for the Hugo, I read everything but The City and the City. And this was the one that I thought was the most worthy. I actually enjoyed Julian Comstock, but I thought it was too much of a straw man sort of book. You'd have to read. I'm not.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. And I enjoyed Palimpsest, but I,
anyway. What about Wind Up Girl?
Why are you kicking me off?
Because we're running out of time.
Oh, we're not.
Wind Up Girl.
What? We're not running out of time.
Okay.
Keep going.
Well, off you go then. Okay.
You are so being so rude to me today. I just since you got that stick, it's been downhill. I'm not the one who spent half an hour talking about gender. So
I'm going to talk some more right now.
I'm in so much trouble from everyone. I'll tell you why actually I chose this.
Yep.
I made a point when I was doing my Tom. You remember I did those Tom Dish reviews?
Yes.
I wrote about 20 Tom Dish reviews that no one read. So when I was doing those reviews, I made the point that no one seems to be writing politically charged novels anymore. It seems to all be about space opera, and there isn't that thread of political ideology going mm-hmm. through books. This is a book that is all about politics and about ideology and about how we're fucking up our world. And basically a pessimistic view on that reaction. This is not a cautionary tale, The Wine Up Girl. The Wine Up Girl isn't saying, if we don't do it, we'll be all right.
This is high dystopia.
Basically, we're fucked.
Yeah.
And it's going to be springs and genetic manipulation that's going to cause disease and all sorts of weird mutations. And basically, yeah.
It's the worst of all possible worlds.
And that's – and Badger Galupi himself – has said, well, has that's why he's writing a young adult fiction, apparently,
such as
The Shipbreaker, because he feels he can convince children.
Oh, is that young adult?
Yeah, Shipbreaker's young adult. And apparently a better book. But anyway. What? It's apparently a better book.
Anyway. Yep.
Coot Street said that. They know everything.
Okay.
He thinks that focusing on children, well, young adult, not children, he's got a better chance of getting the message across. Whereas us 30-somethings and older, we're stuffed. We'll keep
making the
same mistakes.
Right, and we're not going to be doing a whole bunch. I mean,
what's our carbon footprint doing this podcast? iPad, these terrible microphones.
They're not terrible.
That's not what you said before.
Don't mock the microphone.
So, the book.
The book.
Get to the point, Kirsten. I had a question. Why did this get nominated for a Hugo, and why did it win? And the reason I ask that, there was a reason behind that question, isn't because this is a terrible, unworthy book, but because it's a white man, and I assume Paolo Bacigalupi is, no, he's not Anglo-Saxon, but then he's Caucasian.
But he's not Thai, is what you're saying.
Are you trying to stop me before I say something really offensive?
I'm heading you off at the pass.
Was I getting there? I was, wasn't I? Sorry, Paolo. Not that, anyway. Yes, he's not Thai, writing about Thai culture, not exactly in a happy way. Now, he does say at the end of the book in his little...
He's not writing about Thai culture.
Yes, he is. He's
not writing about Thai culture now. He's writing about 200 years from now.
It's got an antecedent somewhere. Corruption that he writes about didn't just spring as a result of the... of what was going on. His influence...
Yeah, but, I mean, he's not... I don't think the book is saying that the corruption is... I mean, you've got corruption in the calorie companies.
The racism,
the corruption is everywhere.
Against Chinese Malay
is
racism that is acknowledged in Thailand right now.
Yep.
So this argument that this is a Thailand of 200 years from now, which is so radically different to the Thailand... And, of course, it's different in the sense that they don't have elephants walking around doing megadons. Doing wind-up-y stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, that's different. But the fundamental stuff, the corruption, all that, he's based that on something, on an antecedent, which is today.
Well, he's extrapolated from now.
You say it so much nicer than me, but yes.
he's extrapolated everything in the book from now.
Now, I mentioned Jonathan earlier on, who's a reviewer for The Zone, which mm-hmm. is a very good website, and he's an excellent reviewer, a really good critic. And his argument in his review, because he wasn't that favourable of the book either. I mean, he thinks it's an important book, but he doesn't think it's a great book. Mm. He has two arguments. The first is that he doesn't think it actually has got a narrative, an overarching narrative. It just seems to be a bunch of set pieces without really a beginning, middle and end. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that point.
Yep.
And I don't mean to paraphrase you, Jonathan. I mean, people should read his review, so I apologise.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that. The second one, he says that this is... And this is actually quite a compelling argument, though, again, I don't entirely agree, is that this is Anderson Lake's story, and this is actually an American perspective on Thailand of that time and of the situation that's going on. This is very much...
He's not the only point of view character.
Well, he says that, but, Jonathan, but he says the other point of view characters compared to Anderson get a bit of short shrift in terms of their opinions and views. I'm not doing a very good job in going over his review, and I have, Jonathan, please write back and say how I got it wrong. But the point I'm trying to make is that with all the race fail that went on in 2009.
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's be fair here. Race fail didn't actually start because someone wrote a book that was culturally appropriating another, you know, of another culture. Okay. It actually started, and I did some research on this, because yes, I'm getting my face close to the microphone. Kirsten keeps waving at me.
Because you keep fading out.
I don't. People can, your levelator will fix it.
That's levelator can't fix what it doesn't hear.
This is so unprofessional. So, race fail started partly because Elizabeth Baer, in her post about writing for The Other, sort of made out that she wasn't a white person writing stuff, that she had so many different bits of ancestry, Indian, this, that, and the other.
We're all human beings, so blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and that got a lot of people upset because they said, no, you actually are a privileged white author.
Yeah.
You're not a black person. You're not one of these other cultures or a Wiccan or whatever. You're a privileged white author. And that started the whole fight, okay? That's where it all – and then it became an issue about cultural appropriation. Now, we all agree – this is my rant – we all agree that there's no point in white writers just writing about white characters and because that just that's terrible.
Yeah.
They're always going to have to write about – are things that they don't know about.
Yeah.
My issue is, not that I have a problem with this book for cultural appropriation issues, but why that wasn't raised as part of the debate when it was nominated as the Hugo. Why people didn't say, who the fuck is Paolo Bacigalupi and what gives him the right to write about Thailand in such a way, because he's not lived there. If you were a native Thai reading this book, if this was about Israel 200 years in the future, and I was reading it, not that I lived in Israel, but let's put that aside. I'm Jewish, right? I have
Israel is yours.
Yeah, I'm entitlements. If I went there, I'd become a citizen. If I was a Jew reading it for Israel 200 years in the future, I'd get pissed off. I'd say, fuck off, mate.
Why?
Have you ever lived in the country? What would you know? What sort of extrapolation is this? How dare you?
Well, unless you can
should we bring up the book thief again? No.
No. I'm saying unless you can because it is set in the future and it's not he's not talking necessarily. He has set it in Thailand for very good reasons, actually. Very good geographic and political reasons.
Yeah, okay, yeah, understood.
He's not just picked a country with a you know, pin in a map or anything. And you know, unless you can point to something that he's writing about, which is demonstrably false in a racist way in terms of the antecedents of the book, as you were saying. I'm not sure there's such a huge problem there.
So Jonathan was arguing this is not about the Thai experience, this book. It's about the American experience, Anderson Lake's experience, who's the one who's trying to find the genetic...
Well, it's an East meets West kind of thing.
DNA and all that sort of stuff for crops and
that
he can then copy and send off. And it's about American imperialism as well to a degree and that sort of stuff. But, okay, and I hear what you're saying, that it's an extrapolation based on some antecedents, but that it's not an attempt to attack Thai culture.
I don't think it's...
But in a book where there isn't a single sympathetic character... I don't know, I didn't read this book and think suddenly I want to go to Thailand. I know it's not about Thailand of today, but
should you
go to Thailand?
I mean, that's up to you. But I mean, should a book be a tourist brochure?
No, but you know, I just got a McSweeney's book in the mail, which is stories written by Zimbabweans about Zimbabwe and about how terrible it is at the moment there, in their own voices.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not about five white people writing about Zimbabwe and how bad Mugabe is. Now, that's about a thing going on today. It's not a science fiction novel.
Isn't there space for both of those views?
That's the question I'm asking. That is what I'm asking. Is there? And I don't know anymore. I'm so confused.
I think there is.
I am so confused.
I think there is space for both those views. I do not think you necessarily have to be within a culture to critique a culture. I'm also not saying the wind-up guy is necessarily critiquing culture.
To talk about Israel, people critique Israel all the time.
And I don't think you need to be within the culture to be able to do that.
I also don't
think you need to be within the culture to be able to write about a culture. I think what you need to acknowledge is that you are writing it from the point of view of an outsider.
But his point of view characters aren't just American.
Most of them are not Thai. His two main point of view characters are not Thai. They're American and Chinese.
But he's not Chinese either.
Oh, for God's
sake. Look, I'll tell you what. I'll stop the discussion because we could go on forever.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about one other thing anyway. I look, if people can provide feedback on this one, if I'm confused and I'm being silly about this, please tell me and I'll take it on the nose. And if Kirsten's right again, I'll take that on the nose as well. But I'm just interested. I know Jonathan, because there was some Twitter discussion on this, doesn't agree with that point that I was making. But, again, I don't want to take – Jonathan, I promise you – and this is not Jonathan Strahan. This is Jonathan McAlmont.
Mm-hmm.
I promise I'm not trying to take you out of context here. Please feel free to have feedback. My other point was, and this is probably even more of an issue,
mm-hmm.
the sexual violence in this book is huge. Now, there has been some commentary on that, but, again, not a lot. I mean, Amiko, the wind-up girl, is raped – twice gratuitously in this book.
Yep.
She's a sex slave.
Yeah, and I think there's a balance you kind of have to strike between simply presenting sexual violence and critiquing sexual violence. And I don't think this book critiques it, very well. I mean, it's hard. Well, on a meta level, it kind of does, because there's a bit of a revenge story, but I'm kind of over rape revenge stories.
Well, they were great in the 80s when they did 80s yeah. video nasties.
But I don't think there's a... Actually, can I tell you my opinion of the book?
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean that.
Because before I get into it, I really enjoyed the world building and the futuristic extrapolation, but I had a lot of problems with the book and I was thinking about it. And I think if it possibly wasn't called The Wind-Up Girl, I may not have had as many problems, or some of my problems would have been diminished.
Please tell.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, I mean, cat.
Podcast cat.
Podcast cat, you go. Yeah, no, it's a really good title. I mean, as far as book titles go, it's evocative, it's got connotations. It's a great title.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a great title for this book.
This is fascinating. Please.
Because it's, I mean, you have a book called The Wind-Up Girl.
Yes.
It's not really about The Wind-Up Girl. She's a very minor character. It's true that she...
She's a catalyst. Actually, she's there's more
an
than
action,
a catalyst.
Yeah, there's a catalyst. She's a catalyst because there's an action that she... Well, we're giving spoilers away now, aren't we? So, I mean, she kills the Ministry of Defence... Akarat.
She killed the Queen's Regent. Yeah, the Regent.
That brings Akarat in and that starts the Civil War, which is the climax of the book. So without her, yeah, there's no story there. But it's not really about her. And she gets, I think, in the first third of the book, maybe one point of view chapter. And when you start reading a book called The Wind-Up Girl, I expected more from that character as a feature character, which is...
That's your criticism?
No, which was a little...
Waiting for Godot doesn't have Godot in it.
But there's a lot of waiting. I got the waiting. If it was called Finding Godot, really disappointing. And then I started to think about the wind-up girl, like what would I have expected? And I don't actually expect much more from her. But it feels like this book is, and you can talk about cultural appropriation, it feels like this book is sort of doing to the wind-up girl by appropriating her name as its title what the patrons of the sex club are doing to her. Because it's just using her. It's just using her as the attraction point to pull readers into the book. And it's not really about her. It doesn't offer any proper critique of her or her situation.
So you think that title would have got people reading it just before,
I think the title.
The buzz,
I think the title
buzz.
Is incredibly good. I think it is a really good title. It just pops. It's a fantastic title. In thinking about The Wind-Up Girl, I mean, it was also quite patently clear to me reading the whole book, and which is one of the most depressing things about it, I have to say, is that the whole gender thing, and I can't believe this is something that's not being brought up. Almost the two mate, all of the players in the book, they're all men. The two major point of view characters from in the way I see it, which is Anderson Lake and Hok Seng, who's Chinese refugee from Malaysia. Okay, so they're both men. There aren't a lot of female characters in the book.
But there's one important female character.
The female characters in the book don't have agency. And that's the important thing.
That's wrong.
The wind-up girl doesn't have agency.
No, the wind-up girl doesn't, but the one who works for the who betrayed
she doesn't have her own agency.
She does.
She
makes a very important decision
owned,
towards the end of the
book. She does, but that I mean it depresses the hell out of me that this book, which is set 200 years in the future, and there's no movement.
Would you say that any character in that book has any agency? Anderson Lake doesn't. He just seems to be pushed from one.
No, he's doing stuff.
Yeah, but he's not doing stuff that what are we talking about agency here?
We're talking about because Anderson Lake and Hok Seng and the two General Prutcher and Akarat, they've all got agency in terms of the power they have, what they're able to do.
And the power shifts throughout the novel, yeah. But they do have power.
The female characters don't have agency. Even the lieutenant of JD, whose name just escapes me at the moment, Lieutenant Kanya. Who would kind of appear to have – she doesn't really. I mean, she's owned by two opposing male parties.
Yeah, but she chooses sides at the end of the
book. She does at the end.
But you're saying that choice in itself isn't
– yeah, it's kind of – and the idea that 200 years – and the only other – and then you have Mai, who's the young Thai girl,
yeah,
who works in the factory, and the only other significant female character in there – and she's one of the traders, is a woman.
There's another wind-up girl towards the end.
Oh, there's another wind-up girl. But, I mean, this is it. It's sort of – we're in this world, which is 200 years in the future. This is far, far future. And there are still – I mean, the gender balance is still so profound.
Yeah, but I thought
and
it's Kenya
not just,
was
it's
there.
It's not just in Thailand.
But I thought
it's,
Kenya was there to redress that. I thought that was the point.
Oh, so we have our token female in kind of quasi-power and that addresses that? Fuck off.
Do you want me to go now or can I stay till the
end
of the podcast?
No, I mean, I'm serious and I'm
no,
not
okay.
– and the book is not – and let me be clear. Yep, the book is not it's quite evidently not about gender issues, and I'm not saying it should be. What I'm saying is it's really depressing that, once again, it seems the default cast of characters are male.
Okay, so the argument that, well, it's men that fucked up the world in this future, so it's men who are still fucking up the world – in this book isn't going, because it is men that fuck up everything in this book.
Yeah, if that's the line, if that is men that's fucking everything up, and when you have the end where you have Kanya who makes the decision and tilts the balance of power, and then you have with the regent dead, so the implication is, I guess, that the child queen may be running her own country somehow. So women will fix it.
Yeah.
That's equally insulting. Fuck you again. Sorry, listeners.
Okay.
I'm a bit upset by that.
No, that's...
No, I don't like that at all.
And to make it worse, there's all the sexual violence that, as you said, isn't critiqued.
And then to make it worse, you do have the sexual violence, which, yeah, I mean, it's kind of necessary. I think there's... considering both incidences of it are from Amiko's point of view, there's, to me anyway, seems to be a tone of relish in those scenes.
It's graphic.
Which shouldn't... Yeah, but it's not just the graphic. There's I'm not quite sure I can pinpoint exactly, but it just doesn't seem that... there are just certain words that are used that don't really belong in Amiko's point of view.
That's interesting. And if you had actual quotes, that would... bolster your argument.
Well, it's sexualized words, but it's sexualized, and they're words which are...
Well, I think I know what you mean when she's watching, because there are other girls that are being...
Yeah, but even...
Okay.
Yeah, and even the things that are happening to her, that, I mean, terms, you know, when you're talking about writing sex scenes, which this is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very violent, horrible sex scene, but they're sex scenes.
Do you want to try and find the page while I talk?
Okay, you talk. But no, when you're talking about... Sorry, I am talking. When you're writing sex scenes, there are word choices you have to use, and whether that sex scene is going to be funny or romantic or erotic, it depends on the word choices that are used.
Yeah.
And I'd have
okay, we'll find it, because I wanted to say that. I mean, obviously you'll quote, but I actually thought from a sentence on sentence level, this is just the writing mechanics. It didn't flow as a book. I just thought I did like the there was an up grading of tension and drama and that, but I kept stumbling.
And well, there's so many point of view characters, and each of their stories.
And there's a density to the writing that's a bit annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this is Amiko's. This is chapter 3, which is the first time we have her, and this is the lesser of the two scenes. But it's things like Amiko traces her fingers through the wetness of bar rings, sweat wet slick rings, as slick as girls and men, as slick as her skin when she oils it to shine, to be soft like butter when a man touches her. There's an eroticism and a sensuality about that, and it continues on.
But that's what she was built for. She's a secretary.
I know,
but
that
she's also a sex slave. I mean, that.
Yes, but
yeah.
She also, within her point of view, is rebelling against that.
Yeah, but that comes that you've just read the first instance. That does come later. Now
she's rebelling against that from the first time we see her. She doesn't like what's being done to her. She possibly doesn't like what's being done to her because it's in a brothel and not, you know, just with a master.
Yeah, okay. She's not doing the task.
That wasn't from the actual sex scene, but it's words like that.
Yeah,
I don't think I can read the actual sex scene. But, yeah.
Yeah, there's an eroticism there.
There's an eroticism and a word choice in the scenes which give it a tone that I think is far from being critical of what's happening, really, it doesn't ring. It's a tone that one of the male viewers would use describing what's happening to her, not that I think she would use.
That's very interesting,
which I think was problematic. But again, you could tie it into, well, she's a wind up girl. She's made for this. That's how she's programmed to think. Except she doesn't. She has other thoughts. Well,
but it's instinctual to think of it in an erotic way. But then she's actually built for... Is she built for sex? Because she's a secretary a secretary with benefits.
Yeah, a secretary with benefits, yeah. But again, the whole... You know, when we're talking about 200-odd years in the future, the sort of default mode of peopling the world and casting your characters is just a little depressing.
Yeah.
I mean, forget all the climate change stuff for a second. It's like, well... We're still having feminism 101, really, really.
Yeah, no. Well, that's why I said I'm surprised it wasn't more discussion on this.
Yeah, but, you know, on the other hand...
It's a Hugo book, Hugo nominated, Hugo winning, and this, I'm seeing some discussion now, but the thing won in September.
Yeah.
And it's been around for over 12 months.
Well, it doesn't mean a whole lot of people read it before it won the Hugo.
Yeah, okay, well, you hadn't.
No, I hadn't.
Yeah, well, that's...
Often winning an award like that will get you a lot of audience.
Should we stop now, do you think?
We said what we wanted to say.
Well, I don't know. I've sort of ranted my bit about cultural appropriation, which, according to you, went down like a sad sack of lead.
Well, no, I think... I mean, no, there
instead
is...
you were clever. You twisted my whole cultural appropriation thing by saying the title is a form of appropriation. That was smart.
I think it is.
Who comes off as the clever one? Kirsten. Who comes off as the one who didn't get City in the City? Ian. That's unfair. Okay. And who has the stick?
I dropped the stick again.
I know. I saw that.
I don't know. I don't mind the book. I really like the world building. I think it's an incredibly depressing book.
What do you think of the writing? Because the writing took me a long time to read it.
The writing was fine. I mean, it was very dense. He's you know, pushing a lot of concepts and stuff.
A lot of adjectivity. He uses a lot of adjectives and verb and adverbs and stuff, not L-Y words necessarily. like that bit you just read, actually. He's got a lot of bit of commas and – is it codicils?
I don't know. I didn't mind the writing. The writing was fine. It's a stylistic thing.
You hadn't read any short stories?
No, this is the first of his that I've read.
Yeah, that's the same with me.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to stop reading Paolo Bacigalupi. I think he's – I mean, he's no – I don't know if he's William Gibson reborn. I don't know if this book is important.
Time magazine reviewed the book, and they described it – so ridiculous. They described it as cyberpunk without computers. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Actually, I've heard it. It's now been called biopunk. Can we please just stop adding punk to a word to make up a genre?
Do people know what the word is? There's yarn punk. Fabric punk, I think it is.
I know. It's like, let's just add punk to any word and suddenly it will be edgier, cooler, out there.
I want to write public service punk.
Public service punk. See, already I'd want to read that because punk, you know. Yeah. Public service punk. Pub punk. Pub punk.
Yeah. So, Kirsten, well, I think we've killed both these books. No, look, to be fair, I still would recommend if you're listening to this and you haven't actually read the books but you don't mind listening to spoilers, there's still enough juice in both these books that they're worth reading. Although, if you've got trigger issues, is that the thing with sexual violence?
Oh, yeah. You want to read the wind-up.
No, it's not.
Oh, well, actually, I mean, to be fair, it's well flagged before it actually happens. So you just skip to the end of that chapter. She gets raped. There you go. Yeah. I mean, really, skip to the end.
Personally, considering one of the rape scenes is a catalyst to the rest of the novel, I would probably just not read it. What's the point?
Well, I don't think you need to read the detail to know. Well,
but then she does all the violence, and I think you've got to...
No, I guess so.
Yeah, no, just don't read it. All right, so next week. We're not doing one of these next week. Next month, which will be a little bit earlier than this month, so we're talking about... February 20th will be a release. That's the sort of date.
Yeah.
So you've recommended for me, some people will squeal when they hear this.
Yes, The White Cat by Holly Black.
Yes.
Which I have read just a couple of weeks ago and really like it. It's...
So one sentence.
Book one in the Curse Workers series, trilogy. I'm not actually sure how many books will be in it. But it's quite a self-contained novel and I really, really enjoyed it. So... yes, it's a young adult novel, I think, but
it's going to be an odd show because my book is Last Days by Brian Evanson, which is about a guy who's only got one hand and he's a bit of a detective type who gets dragged into a cult whose big thing is amputation.
Okay.
It's a fantastic book. I love this. It's short.
It's short. That's excellent.
Last Days is a. We should actually say that I don't know about. I don't think either of these books are available as e-books, but they are easily available.
I don't. I'd imagine Holly Black's probably would be.
Oh, okay. But this one isn't. The Last Days by Brian Evanson, as far as I'm aware, you've got to get it from Underland Press.
Yeah, no. The White Cat is a Gallant's book, so I'm
okay. Probably... The only thing is, The Last Days, if you're not into violence and you're not into dark stuff, that's why it's
good. Why are you listening to this podcast?
True. But I'm just warning people that I don't want them to buy something and think, oh, my God, this is so not what I would want to read. So if amputations don't turn you on, but it is brilliant. It is. I'm sort of hyping this up.
You can stop now.
Yeah. Now, there is a third book, though, that we're doing.
Yes.
We need to mention that, too.
We do. Because next month we will actually have a special guest.
You can mention who that is.
It's very exciting. Melbourne writer Felicity Dowker will be joining us for the podcast.
Actually,
next month.
We'll be joining her.
Oh, we'll be joining
we're
her.
We're going to her house.
We are the travelling podcast.
We are. That's our sort of like a unique niche, that we go to people's houses.
Yes. That's our niche.
Yeah. And the book that she recommended was, Kirsten?
Trent Jameson's first Deathworks novel, Managing Death.
No, that's the second.
Oh, that's the second one.
Death Most Definite.
Death Most Definite. Sorry, I've got the other one sitting on the table waiting to be read. Yes, Death Most Definite. So Felicity has recommended that for us.
Yes.
So we should be talking about those three books.
So listeners, you have three books to read. Mm. If you want to.
If you want to.
If you have three books to read. So on that note, how's life?
Life is excellent.
Okay, so the second book. We've already gone for 2 hours, but you see all this stuff about you being in a bunker. Is it going okay?
No, it's going okay. Words are coming out. Right. This is always good.
And my life is going okay too. Thanks for asking.
You didn't give me a chance.
The criticism's going great. On my live journal, I've started doing movie reviews, little capsule
Very
ones.
Short movie reviews.
Did you like them?
I did.
Yeah?
I won't watch any of those movies.
No, seriously, watch them. Well, you've seen Evil Dead, haven't you?
Oh, ages ago, yeah.
Yeah, don't watch Ask the Dusk Ask the Dust. And Battle Royale 2 is an abomination.
Won't watch that.
Have you seen Battle Royale 1?
I have not. And your iPad is making beeping noises.
Is it?
Yes. Let's stop now.
Sorry.
Sorry, listeners.
Okay. So on that beeping note, we will leave you. Do you want to say anything last words?
No, not really.
All right. So
said enough.
We've done three of these. We're going to be doing a fourth. So,
yes, we'll... so read the three books if you want to listen along in real time.
Yes, exactly. All right, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.